You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Elif Shafak's latest book, The 40 Rules of Love, is a modern love story and also a historical novel set in the 13th century. In it, a middle-aged housewife reading for a literary agent comes across a book about the relationship between the Sufi poet Rumi and a whirling dervish known as Shams of Tabriz, and reading that fiction reawakens her own life. The novel is published by Viking. I'm very pleased that it brings Elif Shafak back to our show. Hi.
Hi.
You were here the last time to talk about your book, The Bastard of Istanbul.
Right.
Let's talk a bit about Shams, even though this book has two time frames. Shams is an impoverished beggar, but he still inspires resentment and fear. Why?
Because of his views, of the way, you know, he approaches his, I think, honesty. He's a very honest person. But I have to say, taking a step back, maybe I should say at the very beginning that this is the way I portray, you know, Shams of Tabriz. Maybe someone else will see him differently. And this is something I very much value and I like about fiction. You know, we bring our own gaze, our own eye into the text.
Well, how much is really known about him? A lot is known about Rumi only because he was one of the greatest poets that ever lived.
That is correct. I mean, Rumi is known as one of the biggest poets, philosophers, and mystics in Islamic history, or in world history, maybe I should say. So there's a lot of research about Rumi in academia and in, you know, many other places. But when it comes to Shams of Tabriz, we don't know that much about him.
Although the 40 Rules of Love is less political than your previous book, The Bastard of Istanbul, isn't it political on some levels because all Sufi words were purged from the modern Turkish language at one point, weren't they?
No, not exactly like that. I think as we modernized, we kind of reshaped our language, and many old words, you know, were left behind. And some of those old words were coming from the Sufi tradition, if that's what you mean.
Well, there was the secularization
right.
of Turkey, and Sufism is still a religious tradition.
True. The tariqats, the brotherhoods, as they were called back then in the Ottoman Empire, they were abolished when the new nation state was established. But Sufism as a philosophy, Sufism as a lifestyle, you know,
does it grow out of Sunni or does it grow out of the Shia tradition?
You know, I mean, if you ask a Sufi, most probably he would say that these distinctions do not mean a lot, because at the end of the day, Sufis are very much interested in the essence, not the names on the surface. And that's one of the things that I find very interesting about them, because they think that essence is one and the same everywhere for all of us.
Shams tells one of the characters, a young prostitute who wants to leave a brothel to get rid of the past. He says, beware of the past, and he compares it to a whirlpool that will suck you back into it. Is that a personal philosophy? Do you think that it can work for anyone?
I think in my books, what I like to do is I like to have different characters saying different things, and I leave the interpretation to the reader. But one of the things that I find very interesting about Sufism is its constant emphasis on the present moment. The Sufi is the child of the present moment. But when I say the present moment, it's not exactly this very minute. It is a present moment that has a past and the future inside. It's open-ended in two ways.
You've talked about the new Turkish woman. You said that even though the state gave women rights, women felt that they had to age themselves, defeminize themselves to be taken seriously. How does that work on a day-to-day basis in modern Turkey?
I mean, Turkey is a very interesting country. In many ways, when I look at the situation, the gender situation, women have been given many, many legal rights. And so many women have been brought to the public space, which was a big step, which was a great step at the time in 1920s, 1930s. However, for women and men to internalize, you know, equality, of course, that's something else, and that takes much more time. And in some areas like media, academia, literature, art, women are quite active and they're very visible. But when it comes to other areas, like, for instance, politics, there aren't many women. Unfortunately, the number of women politicians, when compared to male politicians, is very, very low. So depending on which area we look at, we will get a different picture.
Well, in Orhan Pamuk's last novel, he pointed out that among the upper classes, the young women are very sophisticated. They go to Europe. They're fully aware of everything that's going on. At the same time, they're expected to be very traditional in their personal lives, to be virgins when they get married.
Yes. I mean, you know, there's so many contradictions in that sense. And I think the person is always the more difficult to talk about, right? And again, there's so many things we personally internalize, so many abstract things that are difficult to change. But as you said, on the surface, I mean, a person that looks very modern, very westernized, very urbanized can be very conservative, if you will, in her personal private life, and can be very traditional and raised in a traditional way.
In this book, the American heroine is not really free herself. She sacrificed herself to her marriage.
That's true, like many women, you know, all around the world. I think many women make this choice, willingly or unwillingly, knowingly or unknowingly. And for many years, it's okay. But after a while, especially when the children grow up, they face a very sudden loneliness. So that's why my heroine in the book, she's, you know, 40 years old. And I think 40 is an interesting age, maybe because I'm also nearing, you know, 40, that I started to think about this age. But it can be a turning point for women in many ways. And it's an age in which women stop and they start to question their own life, their own family, and their expectations and frustrations.
Well, I've always wondered about the significance of the number 40, because it appears in religious texts all over the place, the Old Testament, the New Testament, I assume in the Quran as well.
That is true. Isn't it amazing? I mean,
why 40?
Right. All around the world, I mean, when we look at the religious teachings, there's an emphasis on the number 40, and it's the same in Islam, in Sufism as well. Like there are 40 steps, 40 stages. And even in oral culture, in women's culture, like when a woman has given birth, for the child to be ready to start life, you need to have, you know, 40 days. So the number 40 keeps coming up in many, many different areas. And I find it interesting. I think it's a very mysterious, very powerful number, number 40.
Your contemporary character, Ella Rubinstein, is an affluent Jewish woman. Is there any reason you made her a Jewish American?
You see, I mean, I think this is something that's happening in almost all of my novels. I like to bring together characters, personalities that might seem to be different at first glance. And it fascinates me, and I think it's the power of literature, it's the power of storytelling, to bring these characters together and to show what they have in common, how they can touch each other, how their stories can influence each other. So I wanted to tell the story of a housewife living in Boston in such a way that when a reader in Turkey, let's say, in Istanbul, reads about her, she can connect, even though that reader has never been in Boston, even though that reader has never had a Jewish friend herself, but they can still connect. So those cross-cultural connections is something that I find very important.
And there's cross-cultural in another way, because this is a novel within a novel.
Yes.
What is it about the novel, the manuscript that she's reading, that she finds so compelling?
It is a novel within a novel. It's a love, basically, within a love. Because I talk about two different loves in this book. I talk about a more mundane, you know, worldly love on the one hand, and a much more spiritual love, if I may say that. In the book, Ella, my heroine, starts to read a novel. And as she keeps reading, she falls in love with the writer of the novel. As she keeps reading, she learns more about Sufi philosophy. And what I was interested in was portraying Sufi philosophy in such a way so as to show the connections. I mean, it always amazes me. I travel a lot all around the world, and I always meet people who love Rumi, you know, dearly. And these are people who cannot find the place of Konya, where Rumi lived, you know, on a map. They don't have many connections with Anatolia or with the Persian language in which Rumi wrote, or with Islam or with Sufism. But when you say Rumi, you know, it means a lot to them. So I wanted to understand this beautiful charm that Rumi has for modern people. What kind of a charm is this that hasn't died even after almost 800 years? So I wanted to show how it can touch Ella and her life, how it can transform her, and how it can transform us as readers and writers.
We associate the Persian language with Iran, but it was the language of Anatolia as well?
Well, it's a bit complicated. I mean, Rumi wrote in the Persian language, but he lived in Konya, in present-day Turkey, in Anatolia. And at the time, Anatolia was a very chaotic place, if I may say that. You know, it was quite a turbulent time.
And borders weren't what they are today.
Borders weren't, exactly. So amidst all that chaos and turbulence, here's a man, here's a philosopher and poet who's talking about the religion of love, the path of love. And I find that very, very powerful.
But you've said that one of your grandmothers was guided by the religion of love. Through Sufism? How strong is Sufism in Turkey?
Oh, the Sufi culture, the Sufi philosophy is strong on the one hand. But on the other hand, I mean, people have been disconnected from it. So I think we are rediscovering it and understanding how important and how beautiful and how peaceful it is, you know? One of my grandmothers, I mean, she's a woman who has lots of superstitions, you know, a lot of love in her life. She wouldn't call herself Sufi, but her understanding of religion is fluid, if I may use that word. You know, it's like water. It's not a static, solid thing, but it's constantly moving, readapting. It's a more holistic interpretation of religion, and that always fascinated me.
And she was a fortune teller as well.
She's a fortune teller. She reads coffee cups, yeah.
In your novel, Shams Can See the Future.
Yes. I mean, this magic side of our everyday life is something that has always fascinated me. There are many genies in my books, you know, fortune-telling, superstitions. And sometimes they ask me, why are there so many, you know, supernatural things? Because I honestly think there are supernatural things in our lives as well. You know, in life there's magic.
Well, you're also suggesting that in literature there's magic.
In literature there's magic, yes.
Because it can take us away from where we are now to some other place. In this case, it opens up a whole new world for Ella, who is just beginning this job.
Right. I so much believe in that. I mean, literature, the art of storytelling, it takes us into different, you know, centuries, places, into other people's stories. And we surpass the limits of the self that has been given to us by birth.
Did you write this book in Turkish or English?
This book I wrote in English. It was then translated into Turkish. And I took the Turkish translation and I rewrote it. So in a way, I wrote this book in two languages.
Well, actually, and more, because you have two different writing styles for the novel within the novel.
That is true, yes. And this is something I like to explore. You know, language always fascinates me. I love playing with letters, with words, with sentences. It's like magic to me. So I like to use different styles, even inside the same book.
Well, you've been talking about the power of love, but love isn't always isn't exactly a panacea. It creates destruction within people's lives, and it does it for both Rumi and for Ella.
Yes, it is true. And I think that's a very important face of love, that it changes us, it transforms. And for it to transform, it has to destroy. So love is not always, you know, very nice and pink and constructive. It is constructive, definitely, in the long run, but it has to change, reassemble, right, reshift so many things in our lives. I think when we fall in love, we start to change.
Is it ironic that you wrote this novel in English after you returned to Istanbul to live?
This is quite unusual for the Turkish literary scene, I must say. Although around the world there have been writers who, you know, who have been writing in more than one language.
You used to write in Turkish.
Used to write in Turkish at the beginning, but since the last 6 years, I've been writing my novels, you know, in English. I wrote three of my novels in English, and I basically enjoy commuting between the English language and the Turkish language. And I think this is the age in which more and more people dream in more than one language. So if we can dream in more than one language, you know, why not write fiction in more than one language?
Well, all languages have certain capabilities denied to other languages.
Right.
English is quite rich, but it doesn't have certain tenses, if I understand completely, that you can conditionals and other things that are only available in Turkish.
That is true. I mean, the English language is fascinating. It is so rich. I think it's the language of precision. If you're looking for the precise word, for the nuances, the word is just out there. The vocabulary is so rich. For me, English is a very mathematical language. Perhaps it's because it's an acquired language, you know? Maybe for a native speaker, it's something else. But for me, it's more cerebral. Whereas Turkish, for me, is more emotional. It's the language of my grandmother, my childhood. So I'm connected to the Turkish language in a different way. And although the vocabulary is different. I find it really fascinating. It's based on agglutination. It's like a train, you know, you keep adding suffixes. So with very little tiny changes, you can play with the meaning radically. And that's very interesting for a poet, for a writer. In Turkish, we have two different past tenses. There's a past tense used for tales, you know, for storytelling, which doesn't exist in the English language. So each and every language has its own assets, has its own strength, if I may say. But I find it very interesting how our personalities, even our voices, and I think even our personalities change as we move from one language to another.
Well, I want to thank you so much for coming back to New York, where the language is English generally, although their Turkish is spoken here.
Yes.
Elif Shafak's latest novel is The 40 Rules of Love. It is published by Viking. It's been a real pleasure seeing you again.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.